from Wondery. I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. I love the smell of newsprint in the morning, and no one was better or faster at getting it into the hands of the public than Hearst and Pulitzer. They relied on Newsies, of course, but as we heard in Episode 5, the Newsies days were numbered once the automobile rolled onto city streets. That's because, of course, the car would totally transform American life. And it would also make Henry Ford a very rich man, too. We're going to tell you all about it next week as we head to Detroit for Ford versus Chevrolet. We hope you'll join us. It's going to be big fun. Thank you so much for listening, and we especially want to thank everyone who's left us a review and sent in their ideas for the next seasons of Business Wars. We're approaching your suggestions with the same philosophy Ford applied to his Model Ts. He used to say, "You can have any color you like as long as it's black." No, that's not how we play it here. We're getting a rainbow of ideas from you, our listeners, and what great ideas. We've got some terrific ones coming up. Just keep those ideas coming at Wondery.com. We get support from Airbnb. Staying in an Airbnb is often one of my favorite parts of a trip, especially on business travel. Instead of slogging to another hotel and waiting in line after you've been driving or flying all day, there is nothing better than landing in a place that, well, really feels like a home away from home. Maybe you've stayed in an Airbnb before and thought to yourself, you know, this actually seems pretty doable. Maybe my place could be an Airbnb. Well, I'm here to tell you it could be. You could be sitting on an Airbnb and not even know it. It might be as simple as starting with your spare room, or maybe even your whole place when you're away. Say you and your family are headed away for a much-deserved spring break. Well, why not Airbnb your place and make some extra money towards the trip? Win-win. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Let's face it, after a night with drinks, it can be hard to bounce back the next morning. But let me tell you, if there's a surefire way to wake up feeling fresh after a night of drinking, it's with ZBiotics. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for that rough next day. ZBiotics produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. I have a friend who had to go to a major conference the night before. Well, you know how these pre-conference cocktail sessions can go. But he cracked open a bottle of ZBiotics before that first drink. The next day, he got up feeling ready to give that presentation his 100%. Head on over to ZBiotics.com/BW to get 15% off your first order when you use BW at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/BW and make sure to use the code BW at checkout for 15% off. Back now to Hearst and Pulitzer, our focus today. And joining us is Gabriel Kahn. He is a professor of journalism at the University of Southern California. He's a former Los Angeles bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal and a frequent commentator on monetization and the media. He's also taught courses on the history of journalism. He recently wrote an open letter to the new owner of the Los Angeles Times, Patrick Soon-Shiong. He's joining me today from the Wondery Studio in West Hollywood. Professor Gabriel Kahn, great to have you with us. Thanks so much for taking time out to talk with us on Business Wars.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm going to jump right in here. Are we in another age of yellow journalism today? I mean, you look at the rise of fake news and some of the sensationalist coverage these days.
So in a word, yes. This is kind of a back to the future moment. As alarming as the current state of affairs is, if you sort of pan back the lens and look over a longer arc of American history of journalism, you can actually see that in many ways we're kind of repeating an experience that this country went through a little over, you know, a century ago. In some broad strokes, the sort of economic business of media and news media in a way was similar to what the U.S. is experiencing now with the internet. So this is sort of the analog version of news on the internet and news on social.
Well, that's very interesting. You know, I thought you were going to be talking about, like, for instance, the fact that you think about the migration to cities, for example, right? I mean, you think about the immigrants who are coming both then and now. You think about the unrest and the social ferment that was going on both then and now. What do you think?
So I think that you're exactly right to look at it that way. The way that I like to look at those new sort of immigrant audiences that came to cities in America about that time is thinking of them as a fragmented audience. So in New York City at the very beginning of the 20th century, you would have large, vibrant populations that did not get their news in English. They got their news in Yiddish and German and Italian and so forth. And they had different media organizations that served those audiences and gave those audiences the kind of news and information that was in many respects comforting, what we now sort of think of as ideological comfort food. So now we've simply divided and fragmented those audiences in a different way, more along ideology than along, you know, necessarily sort of ethnicity or something like that. And the explosion of social media and delivering news over platforms like Facebook and others allows you to kind of create these different bubbles, these different audiences, which exist next to each other, but never actually really bump up and confront each other.
You know, it's interesting because for a better part of a lot of our listeners' lives, certainly a better part of my life, probably yours, there was this idea of objective journalism was what everyone aspired to. And now there's activist journalism. There are all kinds of different forms of journalism that appeal to these bubbles, as you're describing it. Before Pulitzer and Hearst, what about that notion of objective journalism? Were they going against the grain, or did they create something that led to the sort of objective journalism that we saw during most of the 20th century?
That's an excellent question. And I think that, you know, I certainly have that same experience having grown up thinking that Walter Cronkite was the, you know, the pinnacle of trust and fact-based objective news reporting. However, the notion of objective journalism, as you and I understand it, as was basically sort of practiced in this country, I like to kind of give it an artificial date of between, let's say, 1950 and 2000, was really the result of a certain set of market conditions that rewarded news publications for practicing that kind of journalism. Before those market conditions were in place, you had news organizations, newspapers, basically, in the time of Pulitzer and Hearst, fighting with each other tooth and nail for every reader, and therefore essentially being the analog version of clickbait. Sensationalist headlines that are rewarded by audience which doesn't click on them but pays a penny for them.
You know, you got me thinking here about yet another parallel. I mean, you know, what we saw during the era of Hearst and Pulitzer was a literal war, not just a newspaper war, but a literal war that was sparked in no small part by the competition between these two publishers. And you think today about how there are genuine global implications of the fragmentation of this, you know, this media market. It's so crowded out there. People don't quite know where to turn, and that's being exploited by some of our geopolitical enemies.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we are playing with live ammo here, and there's real consequence to this, as we've seen with a lot of the documented interference of Russian actors using news media as a weapon, right? Not just in this country, but in Italy and other places in Europe, in the UK. And it has real consequences. And, you know, that's just important to keep in mind because, you know, I think that what we really have to do coming out of this is develop a different understanding between the public about what they should expect from news media, what they should demand, and giving the public the responsibility for vetting, fact-checking, for asking for some type of verification and foundation in the type of news media that they consume, not simply taking whatever comes across your newsfeed.
Getting a chance to dig deep into the history of Hearst and Pulitzer was kind of, well, it resonated a lot with me personally, I have to admit, because years ago, more than three decades ago, I started in the news business, and I started at a newspaper called the Christian Science Monitor. And that was explicitly founded as an antidote to the Hearst and Pulitzer era. They were fighting yellow journalism. And we had a guy at our paper named David Rode, who now writes for the New York Times. And while he was there at the Monitor, he won a Pulitzer for his coverage of Bosnia-Herzegovina, the conflict there.
Certainly.
And I remember thinking how ironic it was that this was this newspaper's seventh Pulitzer, and they were always, you know, bragging about their Pulitzers. And yet Pulitzer was the very thing. He was the guy that the founder of the newspaper, you know, was really trying to push back against. Were there others pushing back against Hearst and Pulitzer in that same way, trying to clean up the press?
You know, certainly. And if you look back from when the Ochs-Sulzberger family bought the New York Times a little bit before this period, that's one of the things that they professed that they were going to produce in their newspaper, news without favor, without fear.
Right.
That was always present in some level in American journalism, but it was not the dominant form of journalism until after the Second World War, when the news marketplace shifted dramatically. Most people who grew up and remember that era lived probably in a city that was served by one newspaper, that a newspaper had basically a monopoly in that town. There were only a few cities in America in the post-war era or by 1970 that actually had real sort of competitive newspaper markets, New York City being one, Boston and Chicago being another, but only a few. When you have monopoly control of an area, St. Louis, for example, the newspaper then is trying to appeal to everybody. When it tries to appeal to everybody, then its news gets a lot more serious and somber, and its opinion drifts to the back of the sections. And that's just simply a smart business decision, because that way you're not going to offend readers who might have a different ideological stance.
Yeah.
That's the opposite of what Pulitzer and Hearst were doing. They were out there clubbing at each other every day to fight for that reader and woo them over to their side.
What do you think it was, though, after World War II that created those conditions, that hunger for the objective journalism that came to be the standard in that second part of the 20th century? What, I mean, a lot of people sort of are nostalgic for a return to something more like that. And I'm just sort of wondering, what would you say, how would you identify the factors that ultimately led to objective journalism as we knew it?
Sure. So you would say hunger on the audience. I would more cynically say, actually, what it was a great system that newspaper owners had of finding a way that there would be no competition.
Mm.
What you really had after the Second World War was the emergence of television as a, you know, mass media means, which began to suck a lot of advertising dollars that newspapers traditionally could claim for themselves.
Right.
Once that happened, a lot of newspapers collapsed. You had tremendous consolidation. And that's when you had this massive shift between towns and cities that had two competing sources of news to towns and cities that were dominated by one newspaper. That one newspaper, again, the incentive to not upset advertisers, to not upset different readers, becomes this practice of objective journalism, which is, a smart way to feed your audience when you have no competition.
I'm wondering, though, if in a way what we're really talking about was news that was monopolized by a handful of operators, really. And the television networks, to the extent that they had news operations, and for a while there, they did have rather robust news operations, international news operations even, that everyone was looking over everyone else's shoulder to make sure that they had the story that the other guy did.
Absolutely. And that's really where they competed. They competed for scoops, but not for perspective. You had this oligopoly of, you know, NBC, ABC, and CBS, which until 1980 divided up the entire country. And so they were really trying to create a mass audience to appeal to someone in Seattle as well as someone in Miami. And again, when you do that, you get kind of bland vanilla and sober, because that's the safest route. That's the best way not to alienate any potential audience member. So, I mean, if you look at a newscast from 1980, and I show these things to my students, I mean, you know, half of them are asleep by the end of the 3-minute clip. It's so sober and takes itself so seriously.
Eat your peas journalism, I think we used to call it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Was that such a bad thing? I mean, because on the other hand, it gave us a kind of social cohesion that we don't seem to have today. I mean, there was a sort of centripetal force that was created by that sort of news, and it gave us a sense of, some would say it contributed to a sense of unity. Right now, we do seem to be so fragmented, not just as a nation, but you think about the different sources from which we all derive our news. Is that good for democracy?
So that's an excellent question, and I think that, you know, the grass always seems greener. So Absolutely. When you have this type of, we like to politely call it, you know, objective journalism, but it's really also monopoly journalism or oligopoly journalism, where you have gatekeepers because there are, in business terms or economic terms, very high barriers to entry to get into the business.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If you're going to take on an incumbent newspaper, you're going to be spending tens of millions of dollars before you even sell your first paper. And so that's like pepper spray to competition, right? I mean, that keeps the competitors out. And that means that the incumbent can go on practicing this objective journalism, and it does create cohesion. So think of it this way. Even in our political spectrum, there were always these sort of backbencher outlier voices on both sides that were somewhat extremist, but they never got that echo chamber in the media as a result. And so even though they might have existed, they never had a lot of influence. Now, when the more extreme elements can get their audience and find their audience because of the way that the internet works and because of the way that it fragments audiences, they actually have a lot more influence on the center, on the political system. I would say that that's partly the reason why Congress has been sort of stuck in a ditch for so long and unable to do anything, because there's all these different competing voices, all of which can gain traction in some corner of the media in a way that they couldn't before.
Well, I guess it brings you to a sort of normative question, and that is, you know, what's better, right? And it sounds sort of like it's sort of an anvil of a question, but what is better? I mean, are we better served as the public to have more unity of voices, or to have this free-for-all that we currently have? And frankly, that existed during Hearst and Pulitzer's day when they were doing their own versions of clickbait.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they would cover a traffic accident in different ways.
Right.
You know,
the same
accident. And, you know, one would, I mean, this was true for a lot of papers. I worked for a paper in New York City called The Forward, which had been this socialist Yiddish paper in the day. And they used to, you know, my boss used to joke that they'd cover a traffic accident saying, you know, the capitalist drove and hit the innocent workman as he was crossing the street. You know, everybody saw everything through their sort of ideological lens.
Right.
When you get to, say, let's say 1970 or something like that in America, and you've got your Walter Cronkites and you've got these, even though there's a lot of, I mean, 1968 was quite a divisive year in this country, but the news media, for the most part, is playing it straight down the middle. The criticism from people then was that, you know, you had this oligopoly that was deciding the news agenda. The public played no role. It was a bunch of white men in suits at an editorial meeting, and I'm sure you've been at plenty of editorial meetings like this yourself, where you're deciding what's going to go on the front page. There's no input from anybody else, and plenty of stories were ignored, and plenty of those stories were actually purposefully ignored. Early civil rights stories were kept out of the papers for quite some time. People had always thought that, hey, this is too clubby. This is too exclusive, and we need to stop having these few players be the gatekeepers. Well, now the gates have come down and we can see that, you know, careful what you wish for. So it's difficult to think of one as better than the other, although it is certainly, I do, like you, have quite a bit of nostalgia for the news media environment of 25 years ago.
But I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like we might agree that whether this is better or worse, that there is an issue of distrust in the media that has never been quite as high as it is today. Now, I mean, there have been opinion surveys. The Pew folks have been putting these together for years, and they've been tracking an increasing level of distrust in the media for the past couple of decades, really. So now here we are. Does the fragmentation, what does that do to trust? And are we missing something by not having that trust in journalism?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. It totally corrodes trust. But think of how that does that. If you are on Facebook for a significant amount of time, as many Americans are, you're probably going to be in some type of filter bubble where you're conversing with people who more or less agree with you, and those viewpoints are on the political spectrum that is not in the center. You're going to be seeing one version of reality in your Facebook newsfeed by people whom you know, and another version of reality on mainstream media by people whom you don't know. That condition generally makes people more skeptical of the media. So it's partly this, again, I would say it's the marketplace that has led to these types of behaviors in the public.
Is there a way to dig out of that, or should we want to dig out of that? I mean,
I think we should definitely want to dig out of that. And listen, again, as an educator, I have a bit of a bias here, but I think that, you know, media literacy is basically a 21st century civics class. That is where you used to learn about how a bill becomes a law. Now I think you have to really learn in high school how to be a critical consumer of media and also an intentional producer of media, because we all now produce media with a tweet, with a post on Facebook, et cetera. And I just think that we have to be much more aware of the signals that we're receiving and the signals that we're sending, and be, you know, essentially better consumers the way that you would for the food that you eat, reading the ingredient label, basically, but for news media.
Well, you talk about that ingredient label. It sounds like what you're suggesting is that maybe one solution is that we learn to have a kind of diet of news for those who care about such things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, something, I think we might be pushing the metaphor a little too far, but something like the food pyramid for news, right? I mean, think some news that is of a particular ideological bent and opinionated is useful and helps us, you know, understand certain things, and other news, other components that are really much more fact-based and, as you and I would sort of call it, I guess, objective, also have a role in there. But I think what's really there's no room for is the junk food. I think that corrodes the body when it's food and corrodes the mind when it's news.
You know, part of having a strong press, obviously, is having papers with a strong business model. And you've been rather outspoken about this. In fact, I know you wrote an open letter to the new publisher of the LA Times. Tell me a little bit about that letter. And I've read it, but I think a lot of our listeners, perhaps in other parts of the world or the country, haven't seen it. What was your concern?
Sure. So, you know, in Los Angeles, the second largest city in the U.S., for the past decade, the incumbent paper, the Los Angeles Times, which is really the tentpole of news media in L.A., has had a succession of owners. It's been in bankruptcy. Each owner has been crazier and more destructive than the previous one. And now, all of a sudden, a billionaire, Patrick Soon-Shiong, swoops in and buys the paper for a hefty sum and promises great things and has the financial resources to make those things happen. So on the surface, I think straight up, that's a great thing. We've seen this happen with Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post, which took a paper that was right losing money. Now it's making money and it's having a tremendous impact. It's happening in Boston with John Henry and the Boston Globe. It's very easy for people to cheer billionaires who come in and buy a really essential civic institution. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be without concern and some skepticism. Particularly because, again, we're placing our civic institutions in the hands of a few people who aren't really accountable to the public. They might be doing this for civic motivations, and that's great, and I don't question that. But the accountability isn't quite there.
Let's see here. Billionaires owning papers. Where have I heard of that before? Oh,
exactly.
Yeah. Hearst
so
versus Pulitzer, right?
I mean, so there's again, yes. Now, that those two clearly had a goal of beating each other up. And, you know, that was quite obvious. These guys operate largely in separate markets. But again, there's no mechanism to sort of really put a check on that power.
I mean, do you need to have a mechanism that we have a free press in this country? I mean, what's...
Well, I mean, I would like to say that the mechanism should in some way be the marketplace, that the public should demand the way it demands clean air, clean water, things like that. It should demand a strong, you know, news media that respects a certain set of values. And those values might be different in Oklahoma than they are in Los Angeles. And I can sort of account for that. But in order to do that, you know, the public also has to be willing to, I think, sort of do the work. And this is what I mean about media literacy as being the 21st century civics class. You've got to be an educated consumer in this stuff. You can't just go in blindly and suck up everything that you see on a social media newsfeed.
I want to bring it back to Hearst and Pulitzer as we wrap up. You know, so much of Hearst and Pulitzer's battle was a battle for eyeballs, really. But they used different approaches, and obviously they left different legacies. I wonder, as you think back on those days, what do you think? Do you think Hearst or Pulitzer ultimately won that battle?
You know, I've been thinking about that question a lot over the past few days. When you look at both of their careers, I think Pulitzer clearly emerges as the better businessman of the two. He didn't have the same limitless resources that Hearst had to pour into, you know, these editorial ventures. Again, you know, you and I can produce a great magazine if we're allowed to lose $10 million a year.
Right.
Pulitzer really made his own money and got these dramatic circulation increases both in St. Louis and in New York City. And I think sort of showed himself to be better at running the business. Hearst, I think, probably wielded its power in society much more strongly for years in this country. And you could look at that as one way of kind of having the last laugh. But as you remarked at the beginning, we now think of Pulitzer as connected with the Pulitzer Prize, which we think of as being the kind of, you know, Mount Olympus of journalism. And I guess if you were to really think about who left a stronger legacy of the two, again, I think that would be Pulitzer.
Interesting stuff. Gabriel Kahn is helping to train the next generation of journalists. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Southern California, and he's been our guest today on Business Wars. Professor, really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. And that about does it for Hearst versus Pulitzer, folks. We'll see you next week with Ford versus Chevrolet. This is going to be a fun series. New episodes of Business Wars come out every Tuesday and Thursday. Business Wars is hosted by me, David Brown. Our senior editor and producer is Karen Lowe. Jenny Lauer is our editor and producer. The executive producer is Marshall Louie. Sound designed by Bay Area Sound. The program was created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.